Welcome back, listeners, to your favorite unbiased legal podcast, In Summation, The Final Word. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, back again to make one lucky listener's dream come true. I received a request from a listener named Stephen to talk about constitutional issues. Thank you, Stephen, for reaching out. Apparently, as much as Stephen enjoys dissecting the nitty-gritty elements of certain state crimes and how they're argued at the lower level, he wants me to cover topics which go all the way to the Supreme Court, and as such, affect courts all across the country. Perhaps Stephen is a law student taking a con law class. I don't know. At first, this particular request threw me for a loop, because the request was a discussion of the Commerce Clause, which further leads me to believe that law school may be involved. But Stephen, I think we can go through a really interesting case, which is rife with Commerce Clause analysis, and which involves the legal limits of using the Constitution to ban guns from school zones, which is typically a state law sphere of influence. We're going to get a healthy dose in this episode of federalism, which by now I think everyone listening knows I enjoy talking about. We're going to talk about the limits of constitutional authority in crafting criminal laws, and the mechanisms for how average people like you and me try to convince the Supreme Court that a law is unconstitutional. We're going to get to these issues while looking at the following case. On March 10th, 1992, a 12th grade student at the Thomas Edison High School in San Antonio, Texas, brought a .38 caliber revolver with 5 bullets to school. An anonymous tip led to the discovery of the weapon and the student's confession that he was planning to sell the gun for $44. The high school senior was arrested and charged with violating the Texas statute for the unlawful carrying of weapons. But nearly immediately, that charge was dropped, and he was subsequently charged with violating the federal Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990, which carried significantly more severe penalties. The student didn't deny that he had possessed a weapon on school grounds. Rather, he argued that the Gun-Free School Zones Act was unconstitutional, since the foundation of the act was the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, and he claimed that guns in schools was not closely enough related to interstate commerce to grant Congress the power to enact the law. This is the United States versus Alfonso Lopez Jr. I'll readily admit that prior to researching this case, I was only vaguely familiar with the name. It's possible I studied this case in my con law class when I was in law school eons ago. But when I was asked to cover a Commerce Clause case, I knew there were a few criminal cases which could provide for some fascinating analysis, and the more I looked at Lopez, the more I knew this was the one that we were going to do. So Stephen, if you've been assigned to write a paper on any Commerce Clause case, and that's why you've asked me, then I hope this episode gets published in time to help you before your assignment is due. Alfonso D. Lopez Jr. was a senior at the Thomas Edison High School in San Antonio, Texas. The school held around 1,700 total students, making it a bit above average for the Texas high school size. There's not a lot of information known about Lopez himself. He didn't seem to have any prior criminal record, and I couldn't find anything indicating that he had a disciplinary history at Edison High School. So I can't say with any certainty that he was anything other than an ordinary high school senior, except for the fact that on March 10th, 1992, he brought a gun to school to sell. We do know that the original charge was the simple unlawful carrying of a weapon. There was no aggravation for being a felon in possession of a weapon, so reasonable to assume that Lopez was not a serious criminal at age 18. Even though this is a pretty simple and short narrative, there's a lot to unpack here. Lopez came to school March 10th, 1992, with a .38 caliber revolver in his backpack. He also brought 5 bullets, which were not loaded into the gun. He was approached by school officials after an anonymous tip was made to the school that he had a gun in his backpack. He was confronted, immediately admitted that he had brought a gun to school. He was arrested and charged under the Texas Penal Code for the unlawful carrying of a weapon. The following day, the state charges are dismissed, and Lopez finds himself on the business end of a federal prosecution for violating the Gun-Free School Zone Act of 1990. Let's break this down piece by piece and look at what happened. Thomas Edison High School is a public school, meaning that in the eyes of the law, it is an arm of the state or the government. However, there are minor discrepancies as to how school officials can act as opposed to law enforcement officials. One prime example of this is searches of students' backpacks or lockers. In a public school, a school official can conduct a search if they have reasonable suspicion that a search will result in evidence that the student is violating a law or a school policy. Law enforcement, on the other hand, typically are required to show probable cause. We're not going to get into the details of what happens when a police officer is assigned to a school. That's a complicated analysis. But for our purposes here, you should know that school officials require reasonable suspicion to search a student's backpack or locker without consent. The issue of consent is always, always important. I'll repeat that so you understand just how pivotal this point is. A school official does not need reasonable suspicion if a student consents to a search. Reasonable suspicion only applies to situations where the student is telling the school official that they refuse to submit to a search. In the case of Lopez, he consented. He was approached by school officials and questioned. He very quickly admitted that he had the revolver. He explained to the school officials that he was planning to sell it, and he even told them how much he expected to be paid for it. This is Texas, after all. As an aside, let's take a quick moment and talk about anonymous tips and their implication. Let's pretend that Lopez told the school officials to buzz off, denied that he had anything illegal in his backpack, and had refused consent. Would the fact that an anonymous phone call had come in have been enough to permit the school officials to search the bag without consent? This question really boils down to, does an anonymous tip create reasonable suspicion? There's no blanket answer to that. Phone tips, especially anonymous tips, are highly case-specific, and whether they constitute reasonable suspicion or even probable cause is often highly debated in court hearings after the fact. In general, courts will look to the specific nature of the information presented when determining whether reasonable suspicion has been created. Here's a quick example, and we'll move on. Anonymous caller 1 calls Neil Wojdowski Memorial High School and claims that a student is carrying a gun in a red backpack. The school segregates all 350 students who have a red backpack and searches them one by one. Student Sean Locklear, one of the red backpack students, has a gun in his backpack. Anonymous caller number 2 calls Neil Wojdowski Memorial High School and claims that Sean Locklear, a senior, is carrying a .38 caliber revolver in a red backpack, and he has a Hello Kitty keychain attached to the zipper. Sean is pulled out of his home economics class and brought to school officials, where a search of his red backpack with the Hello Kitty keychain uncovers a .38 caliber revolver. Caller number 2's detail has showcased significantly more personal knowledge of the events discussed, and will be deemed to have established reasonable suspicion should Sean's case ever go to a hearing. Caller number 1 is far less likely to pass scrutiny because the caller was so vague that there was almost nothing to point to Sean himself as opposed to any other student who had a red backpack that day. Reasonable suspicion does not extend to a class of people. It is established only for an individual, and in this case, Sean was only one of 350 potential offenders, making it rather unlikely that reasonable suspicion can be found specifically for him. Okay, back to Lopez. He consented to the search, as we noted earlier, so there's no issue with the gun being illegally obtained. He's a high school senior, so in the eyes of the great state of Texas, he's an adult. The school wasn't obligated to get parental consent to speak to him. The school notifies the San Antonio Police Department, who come and arrest Lopez for violating Texas Penal Code 46.02, which makes it a crime for Lopez to intentionally carry a handgun on his person outside his home. A backpack is considered on his person since it's carried close to him. This is a Class A misdemeanor in Texas. It's punishable by a fine of up to $4,000 and of jail up to 1 year. But then something very odd happens. The day after Lopez is arrested, the state charges are dropped. And the reason the charges are dropped is that the United States Attorney's Office for the Western District of Texas, which covers San Antonio, told the county prosecutor that they would be taking over the case and that Lopez was going to be prosecuted under the fairly recently enacted Gun-Free School Zones Act. The act itself was fairly simple. It prohibits an individual knowingly possessing or discharging a firearm in a place that the person knows or reasonably should know is a school zone. Obviously, there are exceptions for school safety officers, law enforcement, unloaded guns in locked compartments in cars, class instruction licensed by the state. This is a federal act, and some schools, especially, again, in Texas, could have instructions which utilize firearms. Lopez obviously doesn't fit any of these exceptions. Violating the act is a federal felony. It carries a potential fine of up to $5,000, so not that different from the potential fine under the Texas Penal Code. But now he's also facing a prison term of up to 5 years in a federal prison camp. Lopez was assigned a federal defender named John Carter, who stuck with this case all the way from beginning to end. The United States Attorney for the Western District of Texas was Ronald Ederer at the time. The assigned prosecutor's name was Pamela Mathey. The judge on the case was the Honorable Hippolito Frank Garcia, a World War II tank-driving veteran who was appointed by President Jimmy Carter to the federal bench in 1980. John Carter saw his appointment in this case as an opportunity to make a constitutional challenge right from the get-go. He knew that Lopez had no chance in this case based on the merits. The gun had been in his backpack, he had confessed, it was at Lopez's own school, there was no question here about factual guilt under the statute. So Carter contested the statute itself. He filed a motion to dismiss based on the grounds that the statute was unconstitutional. Because of the nature of federalism, federal laws have to be justified by some measure of the Constitution for the law to be valid. Congress could not, for example, pass a law outlawing walking on the grass in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Nothing in the Constitution allows Congress the authority to regulate the behavior of people in Philadelphia alone to that degree. There is an entire class in the first year of law school which is dedicated to what Congress can and cannot make laws about, so we aren't going to try to condense that into a two-minute monologue here. But for our purposes, what you need to know is that the Constitution gives specific powers to the federal government. Congress cites to those specific powers when it drafts federal legislation. People who are accused of running afoul of that legislation have the opportunity to challenge the law itself and make the claim that Congress does not actually have the authority to pass that law. If a court agrees with the individual, then the law is tossed aside and the person is adjudicated to have done nothing wrong. The Gun-Free School Zone Act of 1990 was predicated on a part of the Constitution called the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause is one of the most often cited sections of the Constitution used to justify federal laws. The clause itself is very short and very simple. It's found in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution, and reads simply, quote, "The Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes," end quote. In essence, Congress has the ability to set down regulations when commerce between multiple states is implicated. This goes way farther than Brandon Racone sitting in his apartment in Brooklyn, New York, buying something on Amazon from an Etsy vendor named Abby Lillo in Topeka, Kansas, shipped using Heather Coffee's freight service, which is headquartered in Missoula, Montana. That type of transaction clearly deals with commerce involving multiple states. But the courts have also determined that the Commerce Clause can give Congress the ability to regulate an industry or business which sits in one state if their business affects other states. So something like a hotel, which has significant patronage from out-of-state or even international visitors, could have Commerce Clause implications. Or a business located in a singular state, but which has products that are routinely used in interstate commerce. Like, let's say, a company which makes tractor-trailer trucks. The factory may be in Illinois and only sell out of the Illinois headquarters, but buyers would presumably buy the big rig and then haul commercial goods all over the country with it. That invites regulation based on the Commerce Clause. But where's the line? When is the argument just too abstract? There has to come a time when the thing that Congress is trying to regulate just does not have enough of an impact on interstate commerce to justify using the Commerce Clause to regulate it. John Carter's motion argued that a firearm brought into a school zone did not impact interstate commerce to the degree necessary for the Commerce Clause to apply, and as such, the law had to be stricken down and Lopez sent on his merry way. The response from the prosecutor, Pamela Mathey, was that firearms in school are disruptive to education. Educating high school students has an impact on interstate commerce. Therefore, Congress should be able to regulate firearms in schools. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that most people listening to this show will be against having guns in schools. There is no question about the disruptive nature of firearms on school grounds and the potentially disastrous results that occur from that. But is being generally disruptive to education enough to implicate interstate commerce? Cheating on tests is disruptive to education and far more pervasive than firearms in schools. Can Congress regulate cheating on tests because it impacts interstate commerce? There's any number of other situations which are more disruptive to education than firearms. The argument that guns in schools affect interstate commerce is quite difficult to make from a statistical point of view. Carter and the prosecutor argued on the topic in front of Judge Garcia, who ruled that the statute was indeed constitutional. The decision stated that the Gun-Free School Zone Act was, quote, a constitutional exercise of Congress's well-defined power to regulate activities in and affecting commerce and the business of elementary, middle, and high schools affects interstate commerce, end quote. Listeners have routinely encouraged me to provide a little more editorial commentary throughout the course of dealing with the arguments and rulings in the cases I cover. So here goes. Strictly my opinion and take on this decision. It's complete and utter nonsense. This was a judge who did not want to rock the boat with regards to congressional authority and took the easy way out rather than actually weighing and considering the arguments in front of him. Far too many judges have this mentality. Federal judges, whether district court, appellate courts, or Supreme Court, are appointed for life. They cannot be removed except for misconduct resulting in impeachment by Congress and conviction by the Senate, same as a president. The purpose behind this policy is to give judges freedom and leeway to make the right decisions without having to worry about political consequences. A judge who has to be recertified by a president may tailor decisions to politically align with the president's agenda or face removal. But in our current system, that's not a concern. Judges have the ability to follow the law regardless of whether it will upset Congress or not. Impeachment, as we have seen, is incredibly difficult to obtain a conviction on. After losing the motion, Lopez waived a jury and proceeded to a bench trial. With the law declared constitutional, there really wasn't much of an argument that Lopez and Carter could put forward, and Lopez was duly convicted of violating the act. He was sentenced to 6 months in prison and 2 years of supervised release, which you can think of as basically probation. Carter filed an appeal on Lopez's behalf to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers the District Courts of Texas. We've looked at the circuit court system and the appellate process in some detail in earlier cases, so we won't rehash them in any great detail here. But for an explanation, you should listen to the first episode on Stephen Donziger, episode 11, where we do take an in-depth look at the circuit courts. Carter appeals to the Fifth Circuit. His argument, which he had preserved on appeal since he had filed a motion on it, is that Congress overstepped its authority by even passing the law. Guns in schools, he argued, do not have enough of a connection to interstate commerce as to trigger that provision of the Constitution. Under the 10th Amendment, the powers not expressly granted to the federal government are reserved for the states. and many states do have laws which specifically prohibit carrying guns in schools. All states prohibit the illegal carrying of a firearm, but a significant number also make it a separate and more serious crime to do so while on or near school grounds. The state prohibitions are clearly constitutionally permissible. A panel of judges on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decides to take up this case. They hear oral arguments from the defense that the law is simply not appropriately tied to interstate commerce to justify its passage. And then they hear arguments from the government that the unrestricted administration of education has an effect on interstate commerce. Carter argued for Lopez, and Richard Durbin argued on behalf of the United States Attorney in the Western District. Now, this is not the same Dick Durbin who is a senator from Illinois. Typically, cases appealed to the circuit courts will have the same basic litigants. The same defense attorney will make the arguments in the circuit court, although they may add members to the defense team if there's a lot of extra work that goes into the federal appeal. And the representative for the government is typically still an assistant U.S. attorney from the same district where the initial trial took place, and presumably someone who's at least moderately familiar with the case. If it's not the lead attorney on the trial team, him or herself, then it'll be someone else either from the trial team or who was supervising it or who was at least consulted about it. The government argued at the Fifth Circuit that the Gun-Free School Zone Act is no different from a number of other federal firearms crimes. And there certainly are a number of other federal firearms crimes. After considering the merits, the Fifth Circuit rules in favor of Lopez. Judge William Garwood authored the opinion on behalf of himself, Judge Reevely, and Judge King. They determined that Congress exceeded its authority in passing this law because the carrying of a firearm on a person who knows to be on school grounds does not have enough of an effect on interstate commerce to be regulated by Congress. The Fifth Circuit went into some detail about the history of firearms legislation in the United States. It explained how the historical firearms legislation either explicitly stated that it had to tie into interstate commerce or dealt with the production, manufacture, and shipping of firearms across state lines or the use of a firearm in other crimes which involved interstate commerce, such as drug trafficking. But at the end of the day, the Fifth Circuit was unpersuaded by the government's claims and rendered the law illegal as it exceeded the scope of congressional authority. This was a huge deal. I'll get into why it was such a huge deal more in a moment. But having lost, the government appealed, and the case went to the Supreme Court in 1994 when the court granted something called certiorari. Certiorari, or cert as it's commonly referred to, means that the court agreed to take up and rule on the case. So now the case is up before the 9 members of the Supreme Court. It was argued on November 8, 1994, which, considering the crime itself, took place on March 10, 1992, is an incredibly speedy progression all the way from arrest to motions to trial to sentencing to appeal to decision to Supreme Court. As an aside, you may be wondering, how does the Supreme Court decide which cases to take up and decide? On average, roughly 10,000 cases are appealed to the Supreme Court every year. Only about 75 to 85 of those are actually granted cert for what's called a plenary review. A plenary review means full oral argument on the issues and a written ruling. So less than 1% of cases appealed from the circuit courts or state courts will actually get decided by the Supreme Court. About 100 more cases or so, or just about 1% of the cases submitted for consideration, will get a written decision without oral arguments. If the Supreme Court declines to hear the case, then the circuit court ruling stands and becomes the law of the case, and all appeals are considered exhausted. So of those 10,000, how does the Supreme Court pick the 75 to 85 cases each year that they will hear arguments on? The answer is called the Rule of Four. If four of the justices on the Supreme Court vote to hear arguments on the case, then they will be heard. If three or less vote to hear the case, then the ruling from the prior court stands. I don't want to get too far into detail in a 30-40 minute podcast on this issue, but listeners should be aware that the Supreme Court can hear cases from either the federal court system or the state court system. The most common way for a case to get heard by the Supreme Court is an appeal from a federal circuit court. But a case can go through the state court, from the trial court to the court of appeal in the state, and a party can file a petition for cert to the Supreme Court from there. The key is that for a state court case to get Supreme Court jurisdiction, it must have an issue of law that's triggered under the federal constitution. So, for example, a case with a search and seizure issue, or a right to stay silent issue, or a cruel and unusual punishment issue could make its way to the Supreme Court because it deals with an issue that appears in the Constitution itself. By the way, if all of this stuff about the Supreme Court jurisdiction and the process of getting selected bores you, don't blame me. Again, blame Stephen. He's the one that wanted a law school exam help course, I assume. Okay, so now you understand that the fact that Lopez cases was actually picked was really nothing short of a miracle. It's even more interesting when you consider that there was an Eighth Circuit case in 1992 which brought a challenge to the Gun-Free School Zone Act, and the Supreme Court denied cert back then. John Carter argued the case in front of the highest court in the nation on behalf of Lopez. But when a case gets to the Supreme Court, the initial U.S. Attorney's Office no longer argues the position of the government, and the Solicitor General takes over. Here, the case was argued by Drew Days III, who had argued 13 cases before the Supreme Court previously. It may sound trite, but having home court advantage really does make a significant difference. Never having even been inside the chamber, much less on the record while being peppered with questions from the most accomplished jurists in the country, I can say without hesitation that I'm sure the pressure for a first-time litigant is intense. But Carter handled himself admirably. He very calmly and logically made the same arguments which had succeeded at the Fifth Circuit level. He explained why the circuit court's decision was valid and should be affirmed. He discussed why there is simply insufficient basis to conclude that firearms in schools have a relationship to interstate commerce. The logical conclusion was, then, that Lopez should never have been charged with violating the statute because the statute should never have existed. Drew Days' argument for the government can be broken down as follows. He claimed that the possession of a firearm in a school would most likely lead to violent crime, which would have two economic impacts. One, violent crime causes harm and expenses such as insurance costs, which are spread throughout the economy and implicate interstate commerce. Two, firearms in schools will lead to people being unwilling to go to school or unable to focus while there because students will feel that they are unsafe. Having students scared while learning would lead to a weaker national economy, and that also would impact interstate commerce. The Supreme Court decision on this case was 5-4 to affirm the decision of the Fifth Circuit Court that the law was unconstitutional. It's very easy, at least I think, in 2021, to look back at this decision, which was published in April of 1995, and say that this was an obvious ruling. Guns in schools are clearly not conducive to education, and clearly a very bad thing. Nobody's arguing that students should be allowed to bring guns to school. But you can't ban guns from schools because of the Interstate Commerce Clause. That seems pretty clear. But if you happen to be following constitutional law for the 20th century and watch the case go before the Supreme Court, chances are you would have bet the farm that Lopez would lose and the law would be upheld. The reason for that is that the Gun-Free School Zone Act of 1990 was hardly the first federal regulation to be based on the Commerce Clause, and Alfonso Lopez was hardly the first person to challenge a statute based on the Commerce Clause. But it had been over half a century since the courts had actually struck down a law that Congress said had to do with interstate commerce. The idea that the power to regulate through the Commerce Clause was really supercharged all the way back in 1942, when the Supreme Court held that a farmer named Roscoe Filburn was subject to federal regulations through the Commerce Clause when he was trying to determine how much wheat he could grow on his own property to feed his own animals without even selling any of it. Filburn's argument was that he wasn't engaging in interstate commerce or even commerce at all because his wheat was solely for personal consumption. That argument was rejected, and 50 years of decisions which expanded the power of the Commerce Clause more and more began, up until Alfonso Lopez was arrested for carrying a .38 caliber revolver in Thomas Edison High School. Let's talk through the actual Supreme Court decision in the Lopez case. The author of the decision was Chief Justice William Rehnquist. He and the four associate justices who joined him identified three categories of activity which could be regulated under the Commerce Clause. One, the channels of interstate commerce. That's the roads, railways, waterways, and now the internet, though that really wasn't part of the 1994 decision, if you can believe that. Two, the instrumentalities of interstate commerce. That is, the persons or things actually involved in interstate commerce. Three, activities that substantially affect or substantially relate to interstate commerce. Now, it's that adjective substantially which makes all the difference here. Through a tortured analysis, a great many things can be said to affect interstate commerce, but that doesn't mean that they substantially affect interstate commerce. When making a determination as to whether Lopez's possession of the firearm on the school grounds substantially affected or was substantially related to interstate commerce, the Supreme Court considered four criteria. One, was this an economic or a non-economic activity? Now, although Lopez actually brought the gun to school to sell it, because the selling of it was not implicated in the law itself, what the law actually prohibited was a non-economic activity. So even though he was bringing the gun to school to engage in commerce, in theory, the Supreme Court still agreed with Carter that Lopez's conduct, which actually violated the statute, was non-economic. Two, was the gun moved in interstate commerce? The answer was no. Three, has there been a congressional finding that there is an economic link between guns and education? No. This was just based on argument, not facts. And four, how attenuated was the link between the regulated activity and interstate commerce? Supreme Court found that the link was tenuous at best. So after considering those four factors, the Gun-Free School Zone Act was not deemed to be substantially related or to have a substantial effect on interstate commerce and was struck down as a result. In summation, Stephen took us down a rabbit hole by requesting a Commerce Clause case, but I still think there was a lot of really interesting things that went on in U.S. v. Lopez. You really have to wonder about those first few conversations that John Carter had with Alfonso Lopez and, I imagine, his parents. Carter managed to convince them to put all their eggs in a basket which hadn't even been looked at since 1937, the last time the courts overturned a Commerce Clause law. Carter must have been pretty persuasive to convince them that the best defense here is to claim that the statute violated congressional authority instead of claiming that the confession was coerced or someone else placed the gun in Lopez's backpack without his knowledge. But Carter never wavered, and Lopez went along for the ride with him through to the end. I was very impressed that Carter won at the Fifth Circuit. This was really important strategically because it not only convinced Lopez and his family that Carter had a valid argument, but I think it probably gave him extra confidence when he argued in front of the Supreme Court. Arguing to keep a ruling intact is much easier than arguing to overturn, as you're supported already by a judicial ruling claiming your theory is valid, versus having to argue that not only is your opponent mistaken, but that the previous ruling supporting your opponent is also mistaken. I like this case for a number of reasons. I think it's very important to realize that even laws that have laudable aims or seek to enforce things we all agree are in the public good can still be struck down because the way the Constitution is set up, everyone still has to follow the rules. We cannot just enact federal laws to do things that we think are positive. The Constitution has rules built in which determine what types of laws the federal government has the authority to enact, and everything else is determined on the state level. My own personal opinion here is that Carter was right from day one. This statute was improper. I am all in favor of states outlawing guns on school grounds. New York has such a law. But I'm a fan of order and process. I've said this before on this podcast. I am an institutionalist. I believe that rules are important and we shouldn't just put them inside when they get in the way of the things we think are good. I think far too many well-meaning attorneys and judges teeter on making rulings as if the law was the way they think it should be rather than the way it is. That's not the role of an advocate or of a judge. Final thought. We as a society got this one right. It doesn't always happen, but the rule of law got a win. A special thank you to Stephen, whose request led to this episode. I hope this was the kind of discussion you wanted on the Commerce Clause. And if not, let this be a cautionary lesson to all listeners who submit feedback that if you want something specific, be explicit when you ask for it and don't just say, I would like to hear a Commerce Clause analysis. On that note, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, or you can look me up on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Please keep sending requests. I do have a few more in the works for the weeks to come, but if you have a specific case or even just a topic you want to hear explored in depth, send it over, and I promise to do my best to work it in. Thanks also, as always, to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer, and to all my listeners. I appreciate your support and your continued listening to the show. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and you'll automatically get a new episode every other week when they come out. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.